Session number 26588, Alec Wingrave, Reel 1. Session number 26588, Alec Wingrave, Reel 1.
Wingrave, Reel 1. Can I ask you when you were born and where that was?
It was 25th of March, 1920, at Meadvale, a village 2 miles from Red Hill in Surrey. And the village hasn't changed in all the years. It's still the same now as it was when I was born. And then we stayed there for 7 years. I went to school at a Church of England school, St John's, at Red Hill, until I was seven. And then we moved to Kingswood. And I went to a council school then and until I finished schooling when I was 14.
Can you tell me about your parents? What did they do?
Yes, well, Mother was in service before the war. And when they got married in 1919, they lived in Meadvale and stayed there until 1927. Dad was went into the army in 1914. 3 weeks after the war started, and being a shoeing smith, he went straight into the Royal Artillery and stayed until the war ended. He was wounded 5 times and a load of shrapnel inside him, which used to come to the surface after the war. He was never badly injured, but then when he came out, he went to work for the builder where Mother was in service, and they could see he was willing, and so they trained him up as a carpenter, and he proceeded from there.
Do you remember much about your home? What sort of facilities you had when you were growing up?
Yes, when we lived in Meadvale, we lived in a part of a house with an old lady who was in her 80s, and she had 2 rooms and we had the rest of the house. And then Father bought a house at Kingswood, and that was our first own home. And that was until 1934. And then we moved to Kingswood. Oh, we moved to Kingswood in 1934, and then we stayed there until we moved eventually to Yule, a bit close to Epsom. And another house that was very nice, and by coincidence it was sold to a Royal Navy Lieutenant Commander when they moved. And of course, after I was married, is that all right?
Well, perhaps you could come to
left
that.
Left it until later, yeah.
Well, tell me about your schooling.
Well, it was an excellent school I went to, being Church of England, and which we were Church of England by religion. Excellent school, but I only stayed 2.5 years, and when we moved to Kingswood, so then I went to a council school, which wasn't so good. There was only four teachers for 32. So I think there was 132 children in the school. It was out in the country, of course, at Tabworth, and my education with secretarial jobs and chairman's jobs was self-education, really, with belonging to different organisations, political and cycling and football. But I always had an official job. Right from when I was 12, the headmaster said, "You're the secretary of the football and cricket club." So that went on, and I never let go of being official of some sort or other. And I was secretary of the cycling club when I was 16, and then that's gone on through the years.
You left school at 14.
Yes, I did.
Did
that
you
was
have
a normal.
Any qualifications?
There wasn't any qualifications in those days. No, no, I didn't have any. And from then I was just self-educated. I picked up from where Dad left off with secretarial and chairmanship, and I was chairman of a junior political party when I was 17.
Which party?
The Labour Party, which Father was secretary of the senior party. And Well, we've always been in that trend, and I used to get into interesting conversations in the service, particularly with the older people, who always remembered 1930 when pay was cut, and in the Navy, well, all the services, pay was cut and numbers were cut down, the number of ships were reduced and what have you, and I used to get into strong political arguments with the older people and some of the youngsters. One fella came from Gateshead near Newcastle, and he'd never heard of the the about 200 or 300 people marched from
the Jarrow marches. Do you mean the Jarrow marches?
Jarrow, of course, that's where. Yes. You shouldn't know about that. Is that on there? It is. Yeah. The Jarrow marches, and he came from Jarrow, and he was an out-and-out Tory, in a T-boat, and I gave him the history of this, and he didn't believe it. But well, after his first leave, he came back and he agreed it, and said, he said, my father knew all about it. He said he was one of the marches. So I said, there you are. It's one of those things. But
so you were politically active when you were...
When I was young.
Yes.
But I haven't been since.
Do you remember much about the issues that you were interested in as a member of the Labour Party in the 1930s?
Yes. See, in the 20s and 30s, the Tory party imagined all the members, and particularly MPs and that, they believed they were born to control and run the country. But of course, that's a different proposition now. But yes, we were quite strong. And my father got a result in a local election, just a local council election, and they couldn't believe it, because he went to the meeting and he'd rounded up all the members of the Labour Party, and they came and did the voting. And so when the voting was complete, the Tory chairman demanded that they had an election. So they had to have everything printed, and there was a full-blown election in the village. And of course, Dad was defeated hands down, as he would be in a village where, in a country area, people were scared of their jobs and what have you in the 20s and 30s. But I went straight into the print in 1934, and that was it, a job for life. So it didn't matter to me. I wasn't worried about it. And Dad was such a skilled carpenter that he didn't have to worry about it either, because he could always get a job.
So you went into printing?
Yes, in 1934. William Heinemann, the book publishers, and in the publishing office. And I stayed there until I joined the Navy in 1939. And when I came out in 1953, I went straight back into publishing with Odham's Press Limited.
Do you remember much about your first job as in printing?
Yes.
Before you joined the Navy?
Yes, it was very interesting to me, because I was always interested in geography, and being in the publishing office, it was geography. You had to know every village and town in the country, and I quickly picked it all up. Because of my cycling, I'd cycled through 32 counties in England before the Second World War. So I was quite keen on geography.
So what were you actually doing at the printers?
Dispatching small quantities, but we supplied all the quantities, labels and what have you, to different printing companies. And we did the same after I came out in 1953. It was the same sort of work. And of course, Odham's Watford closed, and we had 11 different printers printing for us. So when I was a strict trade unionist, of course, with being a Labour Party man, and I was a chairman of the chapel for a number of years, and then the
before the war.
No, this was after the war. Yeah.
Could I just perhaps talk about?
I've gone on too quick.
War. So you were sending out labels to other companies?
Yeah, labels and distribution lists and the quantities they had to receive of all the different publications that we did, which was a considerable amount. Because everybody read before the war. Now they sit and watch television.
Were you a trade union activist?
Yes.
Before the war?
Well, only as far as they'd allow me to, because I was a junior. I couldn't take any action in official jobs, you see, until I was 21. And, of course, I was only 19 when the war broke out.
Do you remember anything about the political climate before war broke out?
Yes, quite a bit, because we used to go to meetings, and particularly the fascist party, the black shirts, they used to come to Epsom every Saturday night and get on a box and spout. And I used to round up all the Labour Party junior members, and we were in close contact with the communists, and they always used to get there, and we used to shout him down. And in the finish, after about 3 months, this black shirt speaker gave up, and they didn't come to Epsom anymore. And it was quite strong, of course, politics with the Communist Party, the fascists, and the Labour Party. And the Tories just sat there as we were born to reign, and that was it. They didn't take part in any objections or political shouting down or anything.
Were you very much aware of the fact that war was impending in those last few months and years leading up to 1939?
Yes, we did, yes. And Father being very active, he understood everything that was going on, so he used to fill me in with it.
What were your views on the subject?
Well, I was anti-war in the 30s until about 6 weeks before World War II broke out, and then I saw the light that it was inevitable. So I went and volunteered on Trafalgar Day, 39, October the 21st, and of course within a short while I was serving in the RN.
You volunteered for the Royal Navy?
Yes.
What made you choose the Navy?
I just fancied the Navy. I didn't fancy the Army at all. I couldn't stick being in the mud. I was always a very clean person, even as a kid. And when I played football and cycling, the first thing afterwards was a shower. And I thought you would never get that in the Army. And of course, Dad used to tell us about being in the trenches, although as an artilleryman, he didn't see a lot of that, but he saw plenty of mud. And I already had a cousin in the Navy, and he joined in 1937, and he's still on the bottom off Sicily in a submarine, a P-class submarine. She went down in October 40, and the Italians found it about 4 years ago, and so he's still there with all his shipmates.
So you joined the Royal Navy. Can you describe the process by which you came to volunteer?
Well, I went two Saturdays running to Whitehall, which was the recruiting centre. Afterwards, it was moved up to Charing Cross Road. But then I went the first week, and he said, all we want is cooks and engine room artificers. So he said, are you an engineer? I said, not really. I said, I can take my bike to bits and put it together again. And he laughed and said, well, that's not up to the standard we require. So I said, oh, well, I'll blow it out. I didn't want to be a cook. And then the following week, I went up again. And he said, well, you came last week. I said, yeah, well, I said, I'll stand for being a cook. I said, I can adapt to anything. And so I did. And
so you joined as a cook?
Yes.
And what happened to you after that?
Well, I went to Portsmouth and did my training there for about 5 months.
Can I ask you to describe your arrival at Portsmouth and what your first day or two was like in the Royal Navy?
Well, it was comical, really, because when I got there, we had cards, different coloured cards, and that was the watch that you was in, green, yellow, red and blue. And when I'd been there 2 days, the leading hand of the mess looked at my card, he said, what card have you got? So I said, a blue. He said, what are you doing here? He said, you're supposed to be on leave. So I was only in the Navy 2 days and I was back home on leave. Because I didn't realise that the blue card, we're off for the weekend. And so that was my introduction. But I never missed a leave date after that.
So what happened to you when you arrived at Portsmouth properly? Can you describe the first few days there?
Yes, when we got to Portsmouth Harbour Station, there was a chief there ready to meet us. I suppose he'd been contacted from the London branch to say there were 12 of us going to be there. And we marched, which is always said with a joke, because it's amazing how people can't march when they come straight from Civvy Street. And we walked up the road, was only about a quarter of a mile, to the barracks. It's still there. And
which barracks was that?
Portsmouth Barracks, the Royal Naval Barracks, RNB. Portsmouth, HMS Victory it was called then, and HMS Victory was in the dockyard, but the barracks was called HMS Victory as well, and we were broken up into different watches, but we were all different branches. There was blacksmiths, plumbers, cooks, stewards, 14 of us in the same section. And then when we came back off that weekend leave, we started our parade ground drill.
Before you got to that, were you issued with a uniform and kit?
No, they didn't have any. We had tin hats and gas masks and boots, and we had to march again with a joke down to the town, and we went into Fleming's, very famous naval tailors, and we were all measured for our suits, because you see there were so many reservists called up in those first months of the war that they didn't have the kit to fit us out with. So I was 3 weeks in my civvy suit, but with big naval boots on and a gas mask and a tin hat, and that's all we had for 3 weeks. And then they marched us back down again, and we were measured up and checked, amazingly, really, with our suits that they'd measured us for, to make sure they fitted. And the following day we went back and got the suits where they'd made alterations where they were needed. It was just like going to a civilian tailor. We couldn't believe it. And from then on, so we had two suits. They were both what they called three suits. And when we were being kitted out, a young civilian lad behind the counter, he said to me, he whispered, do you want a number one? So I said, how much? He said, £3.05. So I laughed. I said, yeah, put me down. So he gave me a card, an address in Portsmouth, to go and get measured. And so I was the first one in the branch to have a number one suit with gold badges. And that was something, you know, I was quite proud of that, especially for £3.05. And he, apparently all his family, where the house I went to, was women sitting all round at machines making suits, civilian women, and he had a job in the barracks in the stores department, and that's how he got his contact. I suppose anybody that had enough money, he sent them up there to the house ashore, and we had our number one suits, those that could afford them.
Tell me about your training.
Well, as we were regulars, we were all regulars in our class. We had our full civilian peacetime training. So we went through every section of the cookery. And then when we'd finished all our cookery, no, it's the other way around.
Well, could you tell me about that? Did that involve?
The cookery school. You had a month in the cookery school, which was mostly officers cooking. It was all what we call tiddly cooking, in small quantities for six. But we did our duties in the main galleys. And the main galleys, number one and two galley, which were the general service galleys, victualling the blocks, the huge blocks, they victualled for about 8,000. And that was an education. There was probably four or five chief cooks in there that ran it. There was one chief cook in charge, and the rest were did the duty watches, one every 4 days, or perhaps 6 days, for the chiefs, and the petty officers used to have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and start breakfast, and we had to be up with them, of course. And you did every section of it. You all had a week in washing up in the sink, which nobody was very happy with, because everything was greasy, but there's plenty of hot water. So you did that, and then the other cooking, we went to field cooking. That was where you got any old junk that you found around the barracks and made it up to do field cooking. That's if you were out on invasion brigades and such like. You had 6 weeks on that, and then you had 3 months in the bakery, where they baked for every mess that was in there, and I think there were about 12,000 men in the barracks. That's without the officers, because the officers were in a separate block, and they had their own cooks, officers' cooks. And then when the officers' cooks had finished their training, they went across there to complete it, across the road. It was the other side of Edinburgh Road, the officers' quarters. And eventually we went to ships, of course. Oh, so then we went into parade ground, and we had 3 months on that.
So you did the cooking first?
First.
And then parade ground training?
Yes, I think that was the right way round.
And how long did the cooking training last?
3 months. 3 months. And then you finished up with the exams in there. I think I got about the lowest of them, 72% they passed me at, but it was pass. I don't think anybody was dipped. So I got only 72% out of 100. But I was fortunate in the drafts I got that I was able to sort of train up behind experienced cooks and leading hands. Follow them to become a decent cook.
What sort of meals were you cooking?
Oh, well, in 39 and 40, you still got salads and cold meat. And the food was excellent in the Navy, far superior to the Army and Air Force. And the soups were amazing, because everything from the previous day went through a machine, and that went into the soup for the next day. And Jack loved the soups, and you always had excellent food in the Navy.
Can you remember any specific meals that you used to cook?
Well, you did roasts and cabbage, carrots, all the things that Mum did you had in the early parts of the war, before rationing came in, of course. And I wasn't affected by rationing until I went to a Corvette in 1942, and then we did get rationing, and we were running out of Londonderry. That sometimes that was an advantage, because we got a lot of gear from Southern Ireland, which they were able to buy and bring in. So running from Londonderry, which was our base, was a good thing.
Going back to your training, can you remember, apart from roasts and things, what other meals you would put together that might not be around today, for example?
No, not really. They did cottage pie, all the stuff that you made mince first and then covered it with potato and that sort of thing. You lose me a bit because I don't do any cooking now, but yes, everything that is cooked now was cooked then. We had gammon hams, and they were sliced, and they had cold ham for meals, and that went right up till about 1942, when rationing really got bad.
So you trained for 3 months. Where was everybody fed in this barracks? Was there a central...
There were
separate messes?
Separate messes, but the galleys were situated between the messes. You'd have a load of messes, four high, and then the galley in the centre, and then another load of messes, four high. Then there'd be a space where there were lawns and what have you, believe it or not. And then you'd come to another block of messes, and another galley. There were two very big galleys, which could victual about 8,000 people. And we had a problem once when a bomb dropped, a near miss, in the barracks, and all the there were glass roofs in the above the galleys, and of course the whole lot had to be taken away and destroyed. Actually, it was buried because it was too dangerous for people picking it about to try and get food out of it, because the civilians were already on rationing, you see. And all the dishes were laid out in the galleys, ready for collection when the bomb dropped at about 11 o'clock in the forenoon. And so the dishes were full of glass. That was a difficult thing. So I think what they did was quickly got up corned beef, and the potatoes would be all right because they were done in huge vats. So they just had potatoes and corned beef. But that seldom happened. But I don't think the barracks wasn't bombed again, not for 3 or 4 years, till they got some near misses.
So you completed your cookery training.
Yes.
Then you did your general naval training.
No, well, the left, right on the parade ground. They tried to stop that because they said the cooks and stewards didn't need parade ground training. But they found that when they'd been at sea about a month, they couldn't do anything with them. And so they had to bring them all back off ships and give them their parade ground training, because there was no discipline. It's amazing how discipline carries into everything, even in cook stewards and everything else. That they couldn't sort of answer to reply correctly and take orders and what have you. So that they were all retrained. And not myself, because I went to sea and I'd got my full training. But later they started cutting down on the training and they found it didn't work.
Did you also have small arms training?
Yes. Well, when you say small arms, only rifle. Not revolvers, only the officers had revolvers. We didn't have a chance to fire revolvers. Only rifles. And the rifles in my class were 1894, so they were pretty tatty, but they still fired.
What sort of accommodation did you have?
All in hammocks. Everybody was in hammocks. Even chiefs and POs were in hammocks in those days. And the officers, of course, had cabins with beds, but they were not on our side of the main road, so we didn't sort of have any contact with that.
You were in a mess.
Yes.
How many other people were in the mess?
Oh, there'd be about 40 in each mess, and there'd be 6 messes in a block, in one floor, on one floor of a block. There'd be 6 messes of 40, and 3 high, 3 blocks high. Of course, I slept ashore as much as I could. You could get a bed in the Salvation Army or Agnes Weston, Aggie as she was called, Agnes Weston's homes. You could get a bed for a shilling a night. And sometimes they were in cabins and sometimes they were just in blocks where you sort of put your hand out and you touch the fella in the next bed. But they were well worth it, because it saved slinging your hammock every night. And then you had to be in smart in the morning and lash it up before the duty petty officer came round, and you was in trouble if your hammock was left slung. So I didn't used to sling my hammock. If I had to go back aboard, of course, when I was duty, you had to sleep in a hammock. And there was you got a white sheet of paper and it said what time you had to be shaken in the morning. And which was a bit of a joke, because if you was shaken and you slept on, you was always in trouble, because the duty part, the seaman that came around to do the shaking, swore blind they'd shaken you anyway, and you couldn't argue about it. So that was one of the things that you was shaken to get up at 4 to go and start the breakfast.
This is when you were sleeping
in barracks.
In barracks.
Yeah. Similar things happened at sea. Because you had to be woken up. There was no alarm clocks or anything. You had to be woken up to get up and do the first breakfast and prepare the midday meal, begin preparing the midday meal in a ship. So it was a similar routine.
What was your reaction to the discipline and the lack of privacy of Navy life?
It didn't worry me because being a sportsman, I was used to stripping off among the boys. When I joined in, can we go back to that? Sorry.